careful to call it a restoration, not a renovation, because the goal is to realize painter Mark Rothko's original intentions for the space, which were never properly executed. Completed in 1971 and located on a tree-lined block here in Houston's Montrose neighborhood, Rothko Chapel is a modernist icon that is on the short list of any tour of must-see art or architecture in Houston. But describing the structure itself is oddly difficult. It's a standalone octagonal building whose one room houses a permanent collection of paintings created specifically for the space. But it's not exactly a chapel, a gallery, or a museum, although it's partly all of those things. So why all the fuss? To its devotees, the chapel is sublime, a darkened cosmos that facilitates powerful spiritual experiences. The space, which features 14 dark paintings by Rothko, is famous for being dim and moody. It's a sensory deprivation chamber that also functions as a theological deprivation chamber. Many customary signifiers of religion, statues, altars, stained glass, have been stripped away. It is, as Houston architectural historian Stephen Fox puts it, a space that seems sacred for a post-religious world. Enthusiasts have long described how, if given a chance, the chapel's stark minimalism can pull you out of your day-to-day mundanity and force you to turn inward. As Carol Mancusi-Ungaro, a conservator for the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, wrote in 2007, the chapel leaves you alone with yourself, your thoughts, your emotions, your vulnerabilities. The artist did not want the paintings to come out to you. He wanted them to draw you in. The idea underlying Rothko's art, especially the chapel, is that you sit and stare and stare and stare, and after a while, you enter a heightened state of hallucination, soul-bearing interiority, boredom, or all of the above, because no two single experiences of the chapel are the same. The nature of every encounter with the chapel, its supporters say, depends on what you bring to it. But the same minimalism that some people love has also made the chapel an easy punching bag for critics. The space is dark. It has a facade only a mother could love. It offers nothing to hang on to beyond inchoate experience, which could also be said about a lot of pretentiously vacuous art made in the decades since. Texas artist Seth Halverson bluntly said of the chapel, "It's a place where art and life and imagination go to die." Even New York art critic and artist Brian Adoherty, who was a great defender of Rothko, referred to it in 1973 as, at worst, a well-designed crematorium. The critique often extends to the paintings themselves. Gallons of ink have been spilled about their color subtleties and their many restorations, but regardless of how perfectly lit they are, how well they've held up over the decades, the fact remains they are essentially black monochromes. Dominique Dumanil, who, along with her husband John, commissioned Rothko to create the chapel, reportedly said of her first impression of the paintings, "Frankly, I expected color." Rothko, for his part, noted that if it had taken him a year to decide what he wanted the paintings to be, something you don't want to look at. Admittedly, it may be facile to draw a direct correlation between light colors and happiness and dark colors and sadness. Many people find the chapel to be depressing. Personally, I have visited the chapel many times since I was a child, and I have yet to be transported by it. What's interesting is that Rothko himself probably would have been unhappy with the way the chapel has looked all these years. Although he envisioned the space as muted and meditative and made paintings to achieve that effect, it has never looked as he imagined it. In the 60s, Houston art patrons John and Dominique Dumanil offered the New York-based Rothko the opportunity to design a chapel for the city's University of St. Thomas, a private Catholic college. A Russian Jew by birth, Rothko did not practice religion in any conventional sense, but he jumped at the chance to design a Catholic chapel with modernist sensibilities, not another church filled with crucifixes, as his son Christopher says, but something that would speak to a contemporary mind and a contemporary spirit. The project encountered difficulties from the start. The architect, Philip Johnson, was initially commissioned to design the chapel where Rothko's paintings would be installed, but the chapel wasn't big enough for those two colossal egos, and Johnson walked off the project early on when it became clear that Rothko's ideas for the building had no room for Johnson's. Looking at Johnson's design now, it's hard to imagine the triumphal building with its 60-foot spire as the Rothko Chapel. Johnson wanted showy architecture, which could not be further from the low-ceilinged brick structure that Rothko envisioned. Rothko now had total design control over the chapel, which is exceedingly rare for artists. Rothko rented a large carriage house in New York City where he could experiment with the scale model of the room. The building had a big skylight that he loved, and he decided his chapel would have one too. He had regarded the studio as a place to model the chapel, and he ended up modeling the chapel on the studio. It would be an octagonal space with a single large skylight, its most important architectural element and the primary source of light. His dark paintings would exist in a soft glow of natural light that would reflect the changes in season, weather, and time of day. It was beautiful, in theory, but there were practicalities to work out. And in early 1970, 3 years after completing the paintings, but before construction of the chapel began, Rothko committed suicide. In the wake of his death, the Dominils were left to parse out his intentions. What would Rothko do? Dominique Dominil must have keenly felt the onus to fulfill the late artist's wishes, given the monumental solemnity of the chapel, his final commission. To further complicate things, the Dominils had a falling out with the University of St. Thomas, moved the chapel off campus, and made it non-denominational with an interfaith mission of uniting people from different religions. It's unclear if Rothko ever knew that the chapel would not be Catholic. After his death, the Dominils stuck to his design as envisioned, which is why the chapel retains echoes of Catholicism. Its 14 paintings lightly correspond to the number of the Stations of the Cross, and one of its triptychs has a raised central panel that plainly suggests an altarpiece. Finally, construction moved forward. When the chapel was completed, however, a new problem emerged: the skylight. Rothko never visited Houston, but Philip Johnson knew Texas Light, having already designed the Dominils' house and other buildings in the state. He'd warned that a large skylight in Houston wouldn't achieve the soft, ambient Upper East Side light that Rothko wanted. He was right. People who visited the chapel when it first opened in 1971 spoke of a column of light that blazed into the room, simultaneously damaging the paintings and obscuring them, cast as they were in relative darkness around the periphery of the space. All the subtleties of the paintings vanished in the intense Texas sun, and so began years of attempts to try to get the lighting right. First, the curators installed a scrim over the ceiling. This proved insufficient, and in 1976, the decision was made to install a giant baffle that blocked much of the skylight. The baffle worked, sort of, in that it successfully dimmed the light, but it also exacerbated the chapel's gloominess. Most visitors had never seen the chapel without this black spaceship, as Christopher Rothko puts it, hovering above their heads. Many people don't even realize the chapel has a skylight. The baffle didn't just lower the ceiling and darken the space excessively. It also meant that the windowless chapel's single connection to the outside world, its pressure valve, in the words of Christopher Rothko, was gone. Ancient, sacred buildings often had an aperture in the roof that could symbolize a connection to the transcendent. Think of the Parthenon in Rome. Perhaps because we think of Rothko as a gloomy figure, we assume that he intended for the chapel to be an intensely somber space. But while he meant for it to be dark and contemplative, he surely didn't want it to feel like a cave of despair. Given the skylight's importance to the chapel, no effort has been spared to get it right. The new skylight was designed by the Washington, D.C. lighting firm George Sexton Associates, which had worked on prominent museums and houses of worship around the world. The skylight it created is made up of multiple layers of UV-resistant glass screened by louvers, essentially large Venetian blinds, to mitigate Houston's harsh daylight. In addition, the space's glass doors, added to the interior of the chapel in 2000 to ward off excessive humidity that damaged the paintings, have been removed. This restored an entry foyer that feels more spacious and elegant. There's also a smart new visitor center across the street. In a second phase of the construction, the timing of which has been thrown into uncertainty by COVID-19, a new archive building and a programming center will also be built, allowing for more events and for the memorial services, weddings, receptions, and bar and bat mitzvahs the chapel has always hosted. Perhaps the most significant change for some visitors will not be the chapel itself, but the area outside. The Houston office of the Virginia-based landscape architecture firm Nelson Berg Woltz has taken a forgettable patch of land. Who knew the Rothko Chapel had a side garden? and made it inviting with long, pleasant alleys of birch trees. We've also replaced the forbidding wall of bamboo around the chapel's reflecting pool with a more porous and attractive border of tall savanna holly. Enormous thought, effort, and money have gone into this project. The chapel's many fans should be pleased, but will the changes also change the hearts and minds of its critics? I recently visited the chapel, still under construction, but with the skylight installed, on an overcast afternoon. The light in the room was more even, ambient, and brighter than I remembered it. It was still gloomy, but more pleasantly so, pensive rather than melancholy. Still, and with the caveat that I had not seen it with the paintings reinstalled, I remain unmoved by the chapel. While I have grown to appreciate the sincerity of Rothko's ambition, which I think was to deliver no less than the experience of a different plane of existence, two things prevent me from joining the ranks of worshippers: my personal taste and my approach to faith. To love the Rothko Chapel, you have to love modernism, a historic movement that pushed abstraction both in art and architecture to its logical dead end. The modernist architect Le Corbusier said that a house is a machine for living in, and I think the Rothko Chapel is a machine for worship. I've always found it to be a little too dry and puritanical, although perhaps it's not the sparseness I object to so much as the zealous sanctimony it inspires in some people. As for faith, there is the art of religion, and there is the religion of art, and the Rothko Chapel aspires to embody both. With the art of religion, you don't have to buy into the religion to love the art. By contrast, the chapel is a religion unto itself. Demands that you believe in it. Without any theology at its core, however, that belief is unfixed and open-ended. Put it another way, all religions tell stories, and the Rothko Chapel has no stories to tell. Whether this is an asset or a flaw depends on your point of view. Like any religion, the chapel comes down to a question of faith. You either believe in it or you don't. Rothko Chapel is scheduled to reopen mid-July with a limited capacity, timed tickets, and visited limited to 30 minutes. It will remain free. Next up, we turn to our feature article and cover story, What Lies Ahead. And this is a great collection of a variety of articles on different subjects. This first one here is Future Classrooms, very appropriate. Schools opening back up are in the news. And this is related to a chart here of statewide broadband access, where it shows from some lighter areas of less than 44% of residences have access to a decent broadband, and 92% at the darker end of the spectrum, where more people have access to wider broadband. So they say fiber broadband does not reach 1/4 of rural Texans. 93.2% of Texas households with income above $75,000 have broadband, compared with 70.1% of households under $75,000. In some census tracts in Dallas, 100% of households have broadband. In other Dallas tracts, as few as 24.4% do. The most connected is Fort Bend County, right over here in Houston suburbs, at 91.7%. Laredo is the least connected city of over 50,000 households in the U.S., and the least connected is Edwards County out in west central Texas, about 44.3%. And the reason this is important is remote learning will leave lots of children behind. Barring development of a vaccine, some form of distance learning will likely continue this fall. Alice Owen, who helps implement school technology plans as the executive director of the Texas K-12 Chief Technology Officer Council, talks about what that might mean for underprivileged kids. Monthly is interviewing her and asks the first question: how many K-12 students in Texas don't have the internet at home? Ms. Owen replies, anywhere between 25 to 30%. Some pockets are worse than others. In rural areas, providers don't want to go out to lay those last miles of fiber or for broadband access. In urban areas, you see lots of vendors providing broadband, but there's poverty, and parents can't afford the monthly fees. Texas Monthly asks, what does remote learning look like for students without broadband? She answers, you know, that varies from district to district. I've heard great stories of teachers hand-delivering paper packets to the students, but I doubt that's happening on a wide scale. The kids who need schools the most are the ones who aren't getting it right now, so they're going to fall further behind. How have schools tried to remedy this? She answers, some school districts are equipping buses with hotspots and sending them out to the areas with the most need. Other districts are making sure the wireless in their school buildings bleeds out into the parking lots so families can drive over to the schools and sit in a parking lot to do schoolwork. But there's a need for longer-term solutions, particularly because we know districts are going to have huge budget cuts. The last question Texas Monthly asks, do you think there's any chance broadband could become a public utility? And Alice Owens, the executive director of the Texas K-12 Technology Officer Council, who would know, answers, it needs to be one. It should be a public right to have broadband, just like you have water or electricity, because it's become that vital in our lives. That interview is for Ben Rowan and edited for Clarity and Length. Next piece is entitled, from the same section, Future Politics. Entitled, the next legislature will meet amid an economic nightmare. What could go wrong? And this next piece here starts by Christopher Hooks. It's with an editor's note. The following events have not actually happened yet. Dateline, March 24th, 2021. Yesterday marked the halfway point of the 87th Texas legislature, one of the wildest and most contentious we've ever seen. We've made it 70 days, and we can, with God's grace and infinite forbearance, make it another 70. Here's your weekly roundup. On Friday, House Speaker Tracy O. King put an early end to his chamber's proceedings to convene a weekend retreat for the House Democratic Caucus at a ranch near his South Texas hometown of Uvalde. Confab did not go well, sources in the caucus say, and not merely because it is difficult to get 76 lawmakers to stay 6 feet apart from each other. 3 months after King's shock election as Speaker, House Democrats remained deeply divided. Wasn't supposed to be this way. In the November 2020 election, Democrats picked up 9 seats, winning control of the lower chamber of the legislature, 76 seats to 74. A new day in Texas. Those modest hopes were dashed, however, when the session started and the bulk of House Republicans and a handful of conservative Democrats voted for King, a conservative rural Democrat who's been described as alternately quietly confident or quiet. King, you may remember, switched his vote to himself midstream, feeding a rumor that he didn't know about the plan to elevate him as Speaker. The Uvalde setup meeting repeatedly devolved into shouting matches as lawmakers struggle to be heard over long distances. Progressive lawmakers took turns lashing out at Speaker Pro Tem Greg Bonin, the Republican brother of disgraced former Speaker Dennis Bonin, and House Whip Ryan Gwillen, whose main project this session has been protecting a tax break for yacht buyers that he helped pass last session. There are a lot of fights left to come, particularly over the apocalyptic budget situation, but at least the long-awaited bloodbath over redistricting has been postponed thanks to the delay in the release of census data. Democrats returned to Austin on Sunday very hoarse. Thursday saw one of the largest protests of the session so far. Usually these events feature roving gangs of armed men, including State Representative Briscoe Kane, who was taken to dressing in a buckskin outfit and carrying a muzzle-loading black powder rifle etched with "Ghetto, come and take it." But the protest Thursday was organized by a group called the Patriot Mothers Against Future Vaccines, which aims to pressure the ledge to pass a law to prevent a potential COVID-19 vaccine from becoming mandatory. Amid throngs of protesters with signs denouncing Bill Gates and George Soros and 5G, former state representative and PMAFV advisor Bill Zedler held forth with a gang of mothers. A reporter asks, what's with the name? Well, Zedler replied, the earliest vaccines were beneficial, and the vaccines we have now are dangerous, coughing every few words. If you plot that on a graph, it stands to reason that future vaccines would be the worst of all. Behind the scenes, in the run-up to next week's debate on the House floor, negotiators continued discussing how to plug the $20 billion hole in the biennial state budget. The math is so unpalatable, deep cuts to public education, health care, transportation, etc., that budget writers were initially loath to lay out any plan at all. Top lawmakers now agree on the broad strokes. empty out a good chunk of the $8.5 billion rainy day fund, throw in the billions the feds have given Texas in direct aid, and eke out a few billion more with the budget and accounting tricks the legislature adores. Still, the hacksaw is going to have to be employed to blunt the damage. Left-leaning policy analysts are calling for tax increases that have little chance of escaping even the Democratic-controlled House, while conservative pressure groups like Empower Texans are pushing for a 20% cut across all state agencies. Lawmakers are mindful that the fallout from the Great Recession of 2008 didn't really hit the state budget until 2011, when the economy was still in the doldrums and the federal stimulus money had run out. If $20 billion is the preliminary shortfall in 2021, what fresh horrors might await the state in 2023? That thought has caused some conservative lawmakers to reconsider drawing down the rainy day fund. The state might need it next time, they argue, but that would mean even deeper cuts this year. So the main question before the legislature is a simple one. Who's going to get the blame for this? Expect that dance to take center stage in the closing months of session. It has now been 76 days since Governor Greg Abbott has been seen in public after he abruptly ended his ritual weekly press conference and withdrew from view. Months of unchecked executive power exercised repeatedly during the pandemic seemed to have taken a toll on Abbott. On January 7th, shortly before the start of the session and the return of a branch of government that theoretically offers a check on the governor's power, Abbott issued a cryptic statement that read in part, "I am tired of these people. I'm tired of being caught in the tangle of their lives." His whereabouts and the whereabouts of his dog, Pancake, are currently unknown, although executive orders continue to be issued by his office at an accelerating rate. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick's Senate continues to pass legislation nullifying the ability of cities and counties to regulate themselves at an astonishing clip. The bills include efforts to strip mayors and county judges of the authority to promulgate public health orders broader than those issued by the governor and the legislature, along with exemptions of all kinds of other regulatory powers, from limiting cities' abilities to deny construction permits to overturning local regulations of payday lenders. But the most recent package of bills have shocked even jaded Capitol insiders. On Wednesday, the state senator Charles Perry, who represents West Texas, introduced legislation to abolish the Harris County Commissioner's Court and place Greater Houston under the control of the Texas State Guard. Another bill puts the city of Dallas under a kind of receivership. Mayors of outlying cities in the Metroplex would make decisions for the urban center. When asked at a press conference if these measures violated the once sacred principles of local control, Patrick told reporters that he had merely altered the emphasis of the phrase to reflect its true intent. Locals controlled. Tensions around efforts to protect lawmakers from COVID-19 continue to rise. Legislators are, by and large, much older than the average Texan, and some have serious health conditions that put them at elevated risk. Senators have continued to debate legislation in the spacious floor of the upper chamber, although Patrick has banned reporters from the Senate. The remote system that allows House members to vote from their offices has helped keep endangered lawmakers off the usually crowded floor, but technical problems with the system have derailed votes all session, sometimes forcing members to come to the House chamber. The problem, some representatives still refuse to wear masks. On Monday, a fight nearly broke out when a coughing member of the House Freedom Caucus, sans mask, got too close to State Representative Sempronia Thompson, 82. Some members have expressed concern that House leadership may place six sick members near the back mic on House budget night in order to dissuade dissidents from chubbing or talking at length to kill bills. Committee hearings have been a bit easier, but still far from optimal. Thanks to a change in House and Senate rules, the marathon hearings are typically held on Zoom. A Houston Chronicle analysis this week reported that roughly 34% of one recent meeting of the House Pensions, Investments, and Financial Services Committee was spent on the question of mic etiquette. Eyebrows were raised when State Representative Dan Flynn called his grandson for technical support during a hearing, believing that his microphone was off. The grandson later told Quorum Report, a Capitol Insider publication, "Pawpaw calls me 3-4 times a day, but he's usually just butt dialing." Tuesday saw the first Senate hearing of State Representative Tom Craddock's House Bill 74, otherwise known as the Keep Texas Safe Act, which would require the state to purchase large quantities of Permian Basin crude for the purpose of sanitizing surfaces in public areas, which the Midland oilman explained to the mostly supported Senate Committee on Health and Human Services could include sidewalks and roads. With this effect and still in short supply, Craddock testified, there remains no economical way to eliminate the threat of COVID-19 on Texas blacktop. Critics say the bill is merely a way to prop up demand for oil, but even Craddock's staunchest critics concede that COVID-19 likely cannot survive sustained contact with fossil fuels, and the bill, supported by a wide range of industry groups, is expected to sail through the ledge and land on the governor's desk. Tomorrow means 69 days are left until sign die. Stay strong, Texans. It will all be over soon. Take a little break here real quick. Remind you that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. And since we had that little political slant to that article and we're getting close to election season, I'll hit this other one too. This is back in the state section of our July issue. This section is entitled News and Politics, and it's a profile. It's also by Christopher Hooks. It's entitled High Plains Grifter. Ronnie Jackson was Trump's White House doctor. Now he wants to be the president's best friend in Congress. Amarillo's fortunes have looked better than they did on May 21st when retired Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson spoke at a press conference on the 31st floor of the city's tallest building. Outbreaks of COVID-19 at area meatpacking plants, critical to the region's economy, have been getting steadily worse, forcing many businesses to stay shuttered even as other parts of Texas reopened. Area tumbleweed roamed the streets of downtown. The admiral had a simple message. Brighter days were ahead, and he would bring them. Jackson, who served as the White House doctor for three presidents from 2006 to 2018, had come to publicize the launch of the America First Pharmaceutical Relocation Plan, a campaign he helped kickstart to bring pharmaceutical development and manufacturing to the panhandle. The pharma plan, along with his many, many Fox News appearances, is a cornerstone of Jackson's bid to replace retiring U.S. Representative Mac Thornberry. In the July 14th runoff, Jackson faces Josh Weingarner, who won 39-20% in the first round of the GOP primary, and he's betting that Trump's strong support will put him over the top. Amarillo has wanted to lasso Big Pharma for some time, but the effort has been given encouragement by the Trump administration's desire to repatriate pharmaceutical manufacturing from overseas amid the supply shocks caused by the COVID-19 crisis. In May, the administration directed $354 million to an untested Virginia startup to produce generic drugs and their ingredients in the United States. That's a drop in the bucket, Jackson said at the press conference. He encouraged his audience to imagine that kind of federal money coming to Amarillo with its nearby veterinary and pharmacy schools, ample logistical connections, and business-friendly environment. And it would help if Amarillo had a congressman with deep ties to the president as he was spreading money around. Jackson told the assembled business people and local officials, could his opponent say he had peered down Trump's ear canal? Trump's push to bring pharmaceutical manufacturing back to the United States is happening, of course, because of the virus now creating havoc in places like the Panhandle. But few of the business leaders at the event who skewed older were wearing masks. Neither was Jackson. Former Mayor Jerry Hodge, who is the co-chair of the Pharmaceutical Manufacturing Task Force, said his wife makes him wear a mask, so he cut a cigar hole in the fabric. After the press conference, Jackson walked up and offered his hand to shake. We sat down at a cloth-covered table looking out over Amarillo's rail yards. Jackson is a short, intensely energetic Aggie with a winning smile and a boyish look, despite the graying of his neatly trimmed hair. Jackson's pitch is that he'll be Amarillo's messenger to Trump. "I know the president well. I know all the cabinet members," he said. "I know everybody in the West Wing. The chief of staff, the national security advisor, members of the domestic policy council are all friends of mine." He continued, "I will be one of the few, if not the only, freshman congressman that can walk into the Oval Office unannounced and tell the president of the United States, 'Sir, I've got something I've got to make you aware of.' And he'll stop what he's doing and listen to me." It's difficult to imagine any congressman walking into the Oval Office unannounced, let alone Jackson, whose most weighty piece of medical advice to the president was to exercise more. By Jackson's own admission, that recommendation didn't take. But it's true that he seems to have cultivated a rapport with the Trump family. Though the Trumps mostly stayed away from Jackson until the primary reached the runoff stage, they're sending more and more help to their man in Amarillo. Trump soon tweeted his complete and total endorsement, along with the fundraising link for Jackson's campaign. Donald Trump Jr. has joined in too, declaring in a video that the liars in the fake news media and the corrupt deep state are working overtime to destroy my good friend Ronnie Jackson. It's an unusual and risky campaign strategy. Jackson is trying to appeal primarily to Trump in the hopes that the voters will follow. At a time when the Republican fortunes are directly linked to Trump's handling of the greatest public health crisis in America in a century, here comes the president's own doctor running in a district that's been hard hit by the pandemic. How much does Trump's brand mean here? A little sidebar here. Deep red, the 13th Congressional District is the most Republican district in the nation, according to the Cook Political Report. In the past two elections, the district performed an average of 33 points more Republican than the country as a whole. We return now to the text. Jackson's path to his campaign is highly unorthodox. Born in Levelland, 30 miles west of Lubbock, Jackson served in the Navy some 24 years, more than half of that in the White House medical office. But he became famous only in 2018 after he gave his assessment of President Trump's health at a raucous press conference following Trump's first physical. "Some people have just great genes," he said at the time. "If Trump had a healthier diet over the last 20 years, he might live to be 200 years old." About 2 months later, Trump nominated Jackson to lead the Department of Veterans Affairs, one of the largest bureaucracies in the federal government. His nomination fell apart in quick and spectacular fashion. Several dozen of Jackson's former colleagues in the medical office told Senate Democrats that Jackson dispensed pills, uppers, downers, painkillers, like candy to White House staff. They alleged that he wrote prescriptions for himself and drank on the job. They variously called Jackson the most unethical person I've ever worked with, despicable, dishonest, and incapable of not losing his temper. They also said he was a suck-up and a kiss-up, kick-down boss. The Republican-controlled Senate gave Jackson a taste of his own medicine and kicked him down. Jackson withdrew his nomination. When I met him in Amarillo, Jackson was still fired up about the episode. He called the allegations unsubstantiated, made-up lies that had no merit whatsoever. They were part of a concerted effort to tear me down as one of the president's cabinet nominees. I'd never seen anything like this happen before it happened to me. Now it's happened multiple times since then, including with Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And I tell people now that I got Kavanaughed before Kavanaugh did. I was the pregame or the warm-up, and I didn't really know it at the time. The failure of his cabinet nomination was a humiliation. But when Jackson retired in December, he still had a lot to brag about. He had studied the noses and throats of three presidents. He was left with a generous pension, improved significantly by his promotion to Rear Admiral, secured during his time working for the Obama administration, a lifetime of stories from the front row of American history, and a ticket back to Texas, to which he and his wife had longed to return. A little more than a week elapsed before he made his first appearance on Fox and Friends, the president's favorite morning television show, and the first of more than a dozen appearances on the network over the next 6 months. He got a surprisingly cool reception. Host Steve Ducey told his audience that Jackson had been the subject of serious but uncorroborated allegations regarding his time in the White House. He played a montage of clips from Jackson's detractors, Senator Sherrod Brown. He was so inebriated one night, he went out and wrecked a government car, Senator John Tester, in the White House. They called him the Candyman. That was all a bunch of baseless accusations that were designed to tear me down, Jackson told Ducey. Jackson seemed a little uncomfortable, swallowed hard, looked from side to side, turned in his chair. If you support this president and he supports you and you're out to help him with his agenda, you're going to have a target on your back. Ducey seemed unmoved. One could imagine the president in his bathrobe flipping over the Hate Watch Morning Joe. But Jackson's fealty to his former boss wasn't fleeting. From the beginning of his campaign, he ran as Trump's man in the panhandle. It was awkward then that Trump didn't initially reciprocate. Jackson was the butt of a teasing profile in the New York Times that characterized his campaign as a seat-of-the-pants operation. His campaign manager was a horse doctor, and his wife drove him to events where he sometimes found few voters to charm. But eventually, support from Trump's allies, though not yet the president himself, trickled in. When the Candyman beat 13 candidates to win a spot in a runoff, observers started laughing a little less. The president had seemingly abandoned him, but the mere idea that he was Trump's candidate had apparently been enough. Jackson has one more formidable opponent, though, Weingartner, in the 13th congressional district where Trump bested Hillary Clinton 80% to 17%. The general election is a formality. The Democrats stand little chance. Weingartner, bearded and bespectacled, was raised in Spearman near the very top of the panhandle and has long lived in Canyon, south of Amarillo. In many ways, he's the opposite of Jackson. Weingartner has a solid traditional upbringing in Republican politics, serving as a staffer to former Senator Phil Graham and later Senator John Cornyn. For the past 14 years, he's worked for a trade group important to the local economy, the Texas Cattle Feeders Association. He's never been on Fox News. I guess I'm not on their call list, he says. Weingartner also says he was reluctant to run at first, but was convinced by a sermon series given by his pastor at Hillside Christian Church that centered on the importance of using one's gifts to help others. That was really moving, he said. I've been given a lot of opportunities growing up here. Weingartner says he wants to be an advocate for where we live. He rarely misses a chance to bring up the fact that Jackson didn't live in the district until last year. I'm a local. I've been part of this community for a number of years. All my life, really. Weingartner's staff is less gentle. A member of his campaign repeatedly pointed me to the accusations in the Senate Democrats' report and called Jackson a chameleon who says what he needs to get by. When COVID-19 hit, Weingartner turned his campaign into an aid program for suffering folks in the panhandle. His website serves as a hub to connect those in need, those willing to give. Weingartner says his campaign also helped set up a pop-up food pantry that distributed thousands of pounds of food, and he personally delivered masks to an Amarillo testing site and gowns to a hospital in Dumas. The crisis, Weingartner says, has impressed upon him the urgency of some of the district's needs, among them the chronically slow speeds of America's rural internet network, which is a drain on economic growth. We live in rural Randall County, and even though we've got a pretty decent internet connection, Weingartner said, when you've got two Zoom calls going and two students doing their homework on Google Classroom, bandwidth goes down significantly. Although Jackson has been endorsed by Trump and is staking his campaign on it, Weingartner's backed by a variety of respected local Republican officials, among them Mac Thornberry and State Senator Charles Perry. Weingartner takes great pains to stress that he, too, supports Trump, and his social media accounts frequently praise the president. I'm conservative, a Republican, pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, pro-military, and I think we've got to finish building the wall, he said. I support the president, my district supports the president, but this election isn't about President Trump. It's about who is the best candidate for the district. Weingartner is arguably still the favorite to win, but the pandemic has scrambled the race. For one, it caused Governor Greg Abbott to postpone the runoff from May 26 until July 14. More time is arguably an advantage for the underdog. Jackson's medical credentials also suddenly carry more cachet, and the abrupt halt to in-person campaigning has forced candidates across Texas to rely more on the media to get the word out. Despite his early stumbles on Fox and Friends, Jackson has proved to be a confident and in-demand guest at Fox, making frequent appearances to discuss, among other things, the potential of remdesivir as a treatment for COVID-19 and Trump's decision to take hydroxychloroquine, the malaria drug that the president has repeatedly promoted. Leading from the front, Jackson said. The president is the most transparent president in history. In the end, though, Jackson's pitch to voters is material. My relationship with the president will bring us money. In a way, it's charmingly old-fashioned. Lyndon B. Johnson won his first congressional race in 1937 by stressing his undying loyalty to the FDR and used that relationship to bring money back to Texas. Of course, a good relationship with Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, would arguably be more beneficial to Amarillo than a friendship with a president who has little remaining influence in Congress, setting aside that Trump might lose his bid for re-election. Nonetheless, it's a compelling case for some in Amarillo, like former Mayor Hodge, who founded a local pharmaceutical services company. With Ronnie, we've got a lot of contacts in Washington. A lot of things start here and happen there, Hodge said. Josh Weingartner is a great guy. I just think that for Amarillo, at this point in time, Ronnie can help us get more done in D.C. As the campaign has gone on, Jackson has gotten a few more establishment backers. In late May, he was endorsed by the influential Club for Growth, PAC, while trying to make Weingartner supporters a liability for his opponent. Jackson's top target is Will Hurd, the retiring moderate Republican from a Texas border district who bucked the president on the border wall and instead suggested a tech-driven smart wall. I can guarantee you that people in the 13th congressional district have nothing in common with Will Hurd. He's not even a Republican for most practical purposes, Jackson told me. He's for open borders. He's run around with Beto at length and made something that he's proud of. In May, after Trump called for members of the Obama administration to be arrested for treason, part of a baseless conspiracy theory known as Obamagate, Jackson made waves when he agreed that some of his former colleagues should be brought to justice. Such invective surprised former members of the Obama White House who considered Jackson a friend. It's nothing personal. I did have friends in the Obama administration, he said, but there are still folks in those departments in the executive offices of the presidency that are working behind the scenes to undermine the agenda of our president. People who abuse their authority need to be held accountable. If that means some of them end up going to jail, then that's what needs to happen. In the White House, he said, he was an officer in uniform, bound to a code. Here in the 13th Congressional District, he is free at last to be his authentic self. I don't have to change anything about who I am or what I believe to fit in, he said, flashing his toothy white grin. Next up, we're going to swing over to the Texas Monthly website and read a very important story off of there that they've put up here recently. This is in an online episode section of the magazine online called The Culture. The article is entitled, "This Radio Station Has Served Blind Texans for More Than 50 Years." You may recognize what the story is about, my friends. For many listeners, Houston's sight and the sound is more than a radio station. This story is by Tyler Hicks. Good evening, listeners, intones Chuck Wolf. Welcome to tonight's movie screening. This one has quite the interesting history. Wolf, a Texas Radio Hall of Fame member with 30 years of broadcast experience, sits in a cramped room in the Houston headquarters of Sight and the Sound, a radio station for the blind. His sonorous, radio-ready timbre is heard by thousands of listeners across Texas and as far away as Australia, where the station has at least one devoted fan. Thanks to volunteers like Wolf, the station is able to offer everything from book readings to cooking shows. Volunteering with Sight and the Sound is his retirement gig, a place for him to keep the rust off by reading everything from news stories in the Houston Chronicle to ATV ads for broccoli. Every Saturday evening, Wolf introduces the station's weekend movie screenings with a mix of film history and trivia. You won't believe who was considered for the lead role of this one, he says, introducing Saving Private Ryan in early 2020. These intros have made the broadcast vet a favorite among some listeners who relish the classic radio showman bravado Wolf brings to the sound booth every weekend. When he's done, production manager Jim Martinez takes over with an audio description of the evening's film. While the audience listens to the rat-a-tat-tat of machine gun fire and the deafening roar of overhead planes, Martinez provides a shot-by-shot description of what Tom Hanks and company are doing on screen. You want to make sure you can bring a script to life, Wolf says at the Sight and the Sound leadership. So every time I go to the studio, I remind myself that I am painting a picture, even if it's just for one listener. I have to make them see what I'm seeing. Sight and Sound has served blind and sight-impaired Texans since 1967. Broadcasting 247 from a nondescript glass front office building near the Houston's River Oaks neighborhood, the nonprofit station draws roughly 7,000 regular listeners. The majority now tune in online, though all programming also airs locally on sideband channels of KUHF 88.7 FM and on KUHT-TV Channel 8. The station's audience has limited options for learning the news, hearing about which restaurants have closed, or listening to movies. Screen readers turn websites into audio or braille, but the software only works well when sites are designed with accessibility in mind, which they often aren't, despite legal requirements with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of Guillermo Robles, a California man who sued Domino's Pizza for its inaccessible website and app. As a result, wide swaths of the internet are still inaccessible to the more than 700,000 Texans who are vision impaired. One of our volunteers likes to say, "We are their eyes," says Carrie Musgrove, the station's executive director. During the pandemic, I think that's truer than ever. Not everyone who listens to Sight into Sound is blind, however. People with everything from arthritis to multiple sclerosis find our programming useful, Musgrove says. Anyone who is unable to hold a book or turn pages can tune in, and we'll do it for them. Musgrove's favorite listener anecdote is about a young man named William who uses Sight into Sound reading service to enjoy his favorite graphic novels. Even after moving from Houston to Florida to live with his sister, he still listened to the station. One day, he got lost, and the police were trying to help him find his family. William didn't have his sister's phone number memorized, but he did know how to reach his favorite radio station. "They read me G.I. Joe," he told the officers. Musgrove talked to the officers and William, and ultimately helped the listener find his sister. To her, the call shows how important the station is in the lives of its fans. "These listeners depend on us to do the things that a lot of us take for granted," she said. When the station started broadcasting in the 60s, hosts mostly read aloud the Houston Chronicle or a small selection of books. Over time, the programming branched out. Volunteers started reading magazines like Time and National Geographic, plus grocery ads and eventually movies. When technology changed, so did the name. The station switched from recording on reel-to-reel audio tape to recording on computers, and taping for the blind became Sight into Sound. The organization, which now has 3 paid employees and roughly 150 volunteers, operates on a lean annual budget of just under $400,000. The move to digital meant more followers and more programming possibilities. The station still reads the city newspaper, but now it has a cooking program. The microwave and oven provide their own commentary, courtesy of a cook-dumb comedian, and a weekly tech hour in which listeners can ask IT questions and get on-air advice. On any given weekday, a listener can tune in to a Houston Chronicle reading in the morning, listen to a midday reading of the Wall Street Journal, enjoy a tech hour in the afternoon, and catch the news again at night. Weekends offer even more special programming, like a cooking show or the traditional film readings. The tech program is a particular favorite for Carol, a longtime listener and native Houstonian. Carol lost her eyesight after an injury in 1988, shortly after her graduation from the University of Texas at Austin. She lived in Austin for a while, then moved back to Houston in 1997. She heard about Sight into Sound, walked into the office, and walked out with a free radio. "I love the people," she says. "I mean, what other radio station can you just walk in and say hey and get a free radio?" 23 years after that first encounter, Carol remains a devoted listener. Other stations have been helpful, especially one that was once called the North Texas Radio for the Blind. It was eventually renamed Reading and Radio Resource, and then it stopped production altogether in 2014. She thinks Sight into Sound is the best radio resource for blind Texans, mostly because of the sheer amount of options it gives her and other listeners. "They taught me how to fix my Mac, and they send me a voter's guide anytime an election comes around," Carol says. not just the general election, but any election that's happening anywhere near you. They do things that no one else does. One key difference between Sight and the Sound and similar stations like WRBH in New Orleans is its custom recordings. Listeners can contact the station to request audio transcripts of a specific book or movie, and a few days later, a staff member or volunteer will send them a CD or audio file with the recording. We've read everything from romance novels to religious material, Musgrove says. We've read some really, really weird stuff, but if they send it, we'll read it. That's how Williams sated his appetite for G.I. Joe graphic novels, and in 2014, it's how a Houston cinephile named Thomas realized he could still enjoy the films he used to love. Thomas, 51, lost his sight after a botched LASIK surgery in 2012. 2 years later, he heard about Sight into Sound during his weekly support group for the blind. When you're disabled, sometimes you feel like you're not alive, Thomas says. You're in the way. You're a burden. You're not whole. Then I found out I could enjoy movies again, and I realized that part of who I am might not be gone. Thomas has an expansive cinematic palette. He loves The Color Purple, but he also loves X-Men and the Harrison Ford action thriller Air Force One. I like anything with Kathy Bates or Ving Rhames, he added. If you got one of those two, you got a movie. He has now made Sight and Sound's weekly screenings a part of his routine. He gets his popcorn and his candy, just like the theaters, he says, and blocks out all distractions for the duration of the reading. The only thing missing is a ticket stub, he adds. Thomas particularly loves Wolf's intros. It makes you feel like you're watching it with a friend, he says. It's like you're sitting in the dark listening to a movie, and your buddy next to you turns and says, "Psst, I bet you didn't know Al Pacino turned down that role." Wolf is yet to meet Thomas, but he likes knowing there are listeners out there who love the programming he, the other volunteers, and the station's scant staff put together every day. Like my wife always reminds me, I have a face for radio, Wolf says, so this has always been my calling, but I've never done anything quite like Sight and Sound, because there isn't anything else like this out there. Nowadays, Wolf doesn't go into the studio. Since COVID-19 hit Texas, he's been recording his movie intros and Houston Chronicle readings at home, and then sending them to Martinez. The production manager is the only employee, still goes to the studio every day, but despite a few schedule shifts, the last couple of months have been business as usual for Sight and Sound and its listeners. When he reports for work, Martinez takes volunteers' at-home recordings, splices them together for a full-day recording. Station has even added programming focused on social distancing for the blind. Volunteer and veteran Houston videographer David Halliburton invites listeners to call in and share their tips and perspectives on remaining sane during the pandemic. Then he reads articles on dealing with the despair and sadness inspired by crises like COVID-19. Editions like that have helped listeners like Carol stay connected. The isolation has been harder than usual, she says. Since March, I've only been out of my house to go see the doctor and family once. I can't tell you how important it is to turn on Sight and Sound and learn about what's going on in the world. Thomas agrees. I have a provider that comes over for 4 hours every day to help me cook and clean, but the best of the rest of the time, it's just me, he says. In those moments, I can grab my phone, press a couple buttons, and pull up Sight and Sound. And there's my friend. And with that, my friends, I'm very happy to take us to the end of our reading for today. That was really fun, actually. I was really pleased to see that.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't let physical challenges limit your imagination. Each week, the guys on The Blind Handyman answer questions and offer tips on home maintenance and upgrades.
As we pointed out several times, you do things when you're blind. Many times you do them the same way a sighted person would. A drill is a drill is a drill. A saw is a saw. And you just need to remember, don't get your fingers in it and push the board through it.
You want to make sure that your structure will support this.
We're going to talk about an email that we had gotten about a stove ignition problem.
Assuming that you're blind, John, and you can't read a voltage meter, what do you want to do there?
Most of the new ones in the high-scale reading, it'll make a buzzing noise.
I'm going to talk about installing a micro hood. It's a combination microwave and vent hood.
And we've started drinking early. No, I'm not only kidding.
The Blind Handyman, direct from Lufkin, Texas. Monday nights at 7, Saturdays at noon, and Sunday nights at 11 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 98 and partly cloudy. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 80s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 90s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McClamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the July issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with this article titled Grain Expectations. A nearly extinct variety of rice finds a home in Anahuac through harvest grain mills. By M.M. Pack. Carolina gold rice was introduced to North America in 1685 and became the most valued rice in the country by the time of the Civil War. South Carolina farmers grew it as a cash crop, producing millions of pounds. Without enslaved labor, though, commercial production collapsed, and this variety had nearly gone extinct by the 1920s. But now, thanks to a resurgent interest in heritage grains, ancient varieties of wheat that have minimal genetic alteration or hybridization, Carolina gold rice is beginning to flourish again. Anahuac, a town of about 2,400 an hour east of Houston, is home to harvest grain mills, owned by cousins David Kirkham and Donald Wilcox, who grow and mill organic Carolina gold. Kirkham and Wilcox grew up farming rice with their fathers in Anahuac. Early settlers in the area deemed the terrain most suitable for cattle and rice, and those traditions continue. Irrigation canals cross the landscape, enabling the controlled flooding needed to grow rice. Kirkham returned to rice farming in 2014, following a career in computer technology, while Wilcox raised rice and kids all his adult life. Kirkham's sister, Janie Kirkham, handles marketing and customer relations. It's a family operation, she says. While the cousins harvested their first crop of Carolina gold in 2016, the grain's comeback actually started more than 30 years ago in South Carolina, with Texas playing a vital role. In the mid-1980s, South Carolinian ophthalmologist and duck hunter Richard Schultze became curious about Carolina gold rice. He wanted to attract ducks to his land and taste the rice described in old cookbooks. After learning the USDA Rice Research Laboratory in Beaumont had some in its seed bank, Schultze asked Texas agronomist Charles Bolich to propagate Carolina gold grains for him. The plantings on Schultze's South Carolina farm were successful. This led to a collaboration with Glenn Roberts, founder of Anson Mills, a Charleston-based company that produces organic heirloom grains. The revival sparked significant interest among chefs because of the rice's flavor and versatility. Today, Texas is one of the few places in the United States growing Carolina gold rice, thanks to Harvest Grain Mills. While they're still farming conventionally grown rice in some fields around Winnie and Beaumont, the cousins' goal is to transition to growing only organic Carolina gold and Charleston gold, an aromatic longer grain hybrid released in 2012. Eventually, the family intends to open a storefront at the mill and conduct tours and demonstrations. They're looking forward to developing relationships with Texas chefs and home cooks who appreciate their flavorful rice. "We feel honored to help keep Carolina gold rice in production," Kirkham says, "since it is literally the beginning of the rice industry in our country." All about Anahuac. Designated as the alligator capital of Texas, Anahuac is located on the shore of Lake Anahuac and is the county seat for sparsely populated Chambers County, part of the greater Galveston Bay area. It began as a Mexican fort built in 1830. Its Aztec name means land on the edge of the water. Anahuac was the site of two pre-Texas Revolution skirmishes between Anglo settlers and Mexican soldiers. Today, Fort Anahuac Park marks the location. The terrain might be compared to South Carolina's lowcountry, hot, marshy, and wooded, with lots of rain. This area of the Gulf Coast contains several wildlife refuges and is a destination for fishing and birdwatching. Anahuac celebrates an annual Gator Fest each September. And now for our next article, Tough Shell to Crack. Despite debilitating setbacks, a favorite Aransas Pass area restaurant soldiers on, by M.M. Pack. Terry Brooks doesn't really know where the name for his restaurant, Crabbin, came from. Something he does know, however, is that it takes more than a hurricane and a global pandemic to prevent his popular coastal spot from doing what it's always done, serve fresh seafood and drinks, and look after customers, employees, and friends. The Brooks family has been through hell and high water, but continues the restaurant's mission with grace and pride. Perched on pillings and overlooking a residential canal, Crab Inn, and that's the letter N, was established in 1976 by Terry's dad, Woodrow Wilson Ted Brooks, in the tiny community of City by the Sea, between Aransas Pass and Rockport. Terry and his twin brother, Randy, took over operations in 1978, and it's been a convivial location destination ever since. Known for its BYOF, Bring Your Own Fish, option and fresh cocktails, locals and visitors alike congregate to meet and eat. Sadly, in the past few years, the Brooks family has experienced multiple tragedies. August 25th, 2017, Terry says quietly. That's the day Hurricane Harvey slammed directly into Rockport, smashing much of the coastal bend to smithereens, including the Crab Inn restaurant 5 miles away, which was damaged beyond repair. Then, 3 months later, Randy died of pancreatic cancer. "We didn't consider not starting over," Terry says, but his daughter, Natasha, Brooks recalls being daunted by the obstacle. "We had no idea of the challenges we were taking on," she says. But start again they did. As many Texans discovered, insurance payouts after Harvey didn't come close to the sums required to rebuild. The Friends of Crab Inn, a coterie of customers, put together a loan to cover the shortfall, and the restaurant reopened on February 1, 2020, after being closed for 2.5 years. "We added a deck and reoriented the dining room to take best advantage of the views," Terry says. "People like to look at the water while they eat." The reopening wasn't meant to be grand. "We didn't advertise, and we wanted to start slowly, working out the kinks," Terry explains. "Although 80% of our former employees returned, there were some new ones, too, and everyone had to learn the new computer system. But word of mouth and social media did their thing. 150 people showed up the first night, including some friends of Crab Inn, who met face-to-face for the first time. One was Alto resident Ron Rose, who's kept a weekend home in City by the Sea since 1994. "It's a testimony to the family that so many employees came back after 2.5 years, he says. Server Beverly Trent has worked at Crab Inn since 1980. She's one of a handful of employees who's been there longer than 20 years. She remained involved so long because of the Brookses. The family has always been supportive to the staff, helping us out when we've needed help," she says. Although the Brookses claim no Louisiana roots, Crab Inn builds itself as a Cajun Creole-style restaurant. "In the early 80s, we were looking for menu ideas," Terry says. "On vacation in New Orleans, we loved eating at K. Paul's, and I bought their brand new cookbook, Chef Paul Prudhomme's Louisiana Kitchen." Crab Inn used a couple of Prudhomme's original recipes when starting out, but over the years the dishes have been adapted and changed, and new recipes have been added. Some of the restaurant's popular dishes are crab and shrimp bisque, pecan-crusted flounder topped with crab relish, and crab cakes. Natasha notes they're experimenting with some Asian-influenced dishes. "We just like good-tasting food, and we want to keep innovating," she says. The restaurant also features a full bar with signature drinks, including a pear martini and a variety of margaritas made with fresh fruits, fruit juices, and house-made simple syrup. About 30% of the fish the restaurant cooks is brought in by customers. Nearby, Redfish Bay and Estes Flats teem with sport fish like spotted sea trout, redfish, black drum, flounder, and sheep's head. The kitchen can prepare these catches in a variety of ways, including grilled, fried, blackened, and pan-seared, and pair them with a signature sauce, such as crab and shrimp buttercream or crawfish. As the revitalized Crab Inn was humming along, getting its groove back, disaster struck again with COVID-19. "After only 6 weeks open, we had to close again on March 15th, Terry says. But he remained optimistic during the downtime, tweaking recipes, updating seasonings, and applying for aid to help pay employees. "If you aren't improving things, you're falling behind," he says. Because there were few COVID-19 cases in sparsely populated Aransas County, the county allowed Crab Inn to open at